Looking for the best place to buy tickets for any of your favorite teams or sporting events? We've got the spot. Our partner, StubHub, has been the leading ticket marketplace in the world for over 20 years, providing a 100% guarantee with every order. From a worldwide selection of live events, the widest choice of tickets and industry-leading partnerships, StubHub has what you need to purchase with confidence. StubHub, an official partner of The Athletic.
As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10. Place your first bet on any game and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
The Athletic.
Hello, I'm Mark Chapman. Welcome to the England show on The Athletic. Coming up today, we will look ahead to England Euro 2020 last eight tie against Ukraine in Rome. Flo Lloyd-Hughes, The Athletic's Jack Pitbrook and Adam Crafton are with us. We'll talk to Jordan Campbell later on as well, who was at Hampden to see Ukraine beat Sweden. Off air, he's already had some interesting things to say to me, Adam, about English arrogance, blaming you for English arrogance as well, suggesting that you're making the suggestion that players could be rested for Ukraine.
Rotated is the word.
we'll come on to that in a little while. Adam and Jack, though, have contributed on a massive read, reflecting the night that everything came together. And it did. Everything came together, Jack.
It almost couldn't have gone better in the sense that Southgate could not have been more vindicated for the decisions that he's made, not just over the course of this tournament, but over the last few years. You know, the decision to change the formation mid-tournament, which is something which is incredibly rare for an England manager to do, and to do it after a successful group stage in which England took 7 points and conceded no goals. And picking what was, we have to be honest, a dreadfully unpopular team on Tuesday afternoon, which literally no fans would have chosen. And Southgate said afterwards he would have been dead if it didn't work. And so for it to, for the game to go almost precisely in keeping with what Southgate would have expected and planned for, is just like the biggest vindication I can imagine for him. And just really a credit to all the work that he's done. And what we tried to convey in the piece was the fact that it's really, really difficult at times like this, and players are grumbling about training and they're grumbling about selection. And if it hadn't gone wrong, then this Southgate would have got battered all week for his treatment of Grealish and Foden and not playing 4-3-3 and not going for it and all the rest of it. So, we just wanted to get across what a delicate balancing act Southgate's been doing.
Flo, you are quite keen to point out that you were the only one on this pod who was full of confidence before the Germany game.
Yeah, it's a funny one because, like Jack said, I had friends who don't get that emotional or upset about England who were absolutely raging about that starting 11. Really, really annoyed, saying this is the best opportunity we've ever had to win a Euros, to get really late in the Euros, and he's stuffed it all up with this starting 11. And I was just hashtag trust the process throughout. I thought, you know, we know this is what he's about. We know he's always been like this, as Jack said, and he's not going to just risk it all in one game. And the bench had its impact that we thought it was going to have. He had all the ammo he needed to change the game, and it worked out. So, yeah, I do feel fairly smug to be the one who thought it was all going to work out in the end. But obviously, it's a matter of inches. If that Muller goal had gone in, extra time, penalties, England could have lost. So actually, the whole thing could have gone entirely different.
And that's where I was going to come to next, Adam. I mean, you know, we've worked together a lot, and you know it's very unlike me to introduce a negative aspect to the discussion, but there are fine margins here. There really are fine margins. But in most sport, there are fine margins, and you need a little bit of luck along the way.
Yeah, you're right. Everyone's talking about the Muller miss, understandably, because it was probably the moment of the tournament so far in terms of just the sheer drama of it. But, you know, don't forget as well, Jordan Pickford made two brilliant saves, one from Werner in the first half, one from Havertz in the second half. You know, as important, probably more important in some ways, because England would have gone a goal down. So, yeah, I mean, it's interesting what Flo says about, you know, trusting the process. And I think I'm probably quite reflective of that sort of traditional reactionary England fan, in that I have like three states of emotional being as an England fan, one of which is just bored and disinterested between tournaments, then raging when my favourite players aren't picked or the team is not being particularly expansive at a tournament, and then just utterly elated and on the hype as soon as we hit into a quarterfinal. And I think that's where most of the country's at now. I don't think most of the country really wants any nuance now. I think it is just everyone is now a little bit Russia 2018-y and really, you know, looking at the games that we may have in store, plural, hopefully, and just being super excited now with, you know, a set of players that are just incredibly likeable, and a manager who, you know, I still think that interview that he gave on the BBC within 15 minutes of the match finishing was one of the most extraordinary live interviews I can actually remember from someone involved in sport.
Yeah, I think if anything, actually, people are now disappointed that the new series of Love Island isn't matching up to Russia 2018 levels, because that's actually the bigger frustration, I think, definitely on social media, is the lack of excitement on that front.
Flo, which England player do you consider to be the most Love Island-y?
Oh, Grealish. Didn't even take me 0.5 seconds.
Really?
100% Jack Grealish.
I was thinking, yeah. I think Ben White, since he's sort of got all those tattoos on his arms now, is screaming Love Island. But anyway, now we've covered the big issues.
Yeah, I spent most of 2018 World Cup in a podcast battle at the top of the podcast charts with Love Island, which is a battle I was never going to win, to be honest with you. There are a couple of things from the other night that really stick in my mind, which is the joy of the England players at certain times and the pain of the England players at certain times. So there were two things, Jack. Pre-match, England came out to warm up, and on the radio commentary that I was doing, John Murray described him as looking like he was on a beach. He was kind of skipping across Declan Rice, waving, big grin on his face. And we found out afterwards it was because Mark Noble and his son and James Corden were all in a box, and he'd spotted them. And this was like the first thing before even kicking a ball in the warm-up. The joy and excitement on his face was just lovely to see. And then the pain of Raheem Sterling sinking to his knees when he thought he had cost England with the Thomas Muller chance, I thought encapsulates both how relaxed they are at the start, but also understandably what it means for them. And we've accused England players in the past, Jack, of not caring.
It was emotionally exhausting to be there. Like, I don't want to sound like I'm complaining about being there, because I'm not, but it was really draining. You know, when you go, and this is true whether you're a fan or a reporter, when you go to a football match that big, it really takes it out of you. You could see how much it took out the players. And that moment with Sterling was incredible, because he obviously collapsed. And I think somebody circulated a clip on social media earlier of, I've forgotten which player it was.
I think it was Trippier who sort of grabs him.
Trippier,
yeah.
Lifting Sterling up after that moment. And then I remember Trippier sprinting over and just basically screaming at the England defence, telling them to focus and not get caught out like that again. And Pickford, I remember running, kind of bounding off and charging away and celebrating. At that moment, so yeah, it was a hugely emotionally exhausting day for everyone.
I do love, you know, just watching those clips back, and then you also see the way Henderson celebrated with Southgate for the second goal. Because I think, you know, at times watching them in the group stage, where obviously like a lot of it was like quite slow and ponderous, you sort of fall into this trap as a fan where you're like, are they really up for it? Do they care that much? It's not do they care, because we know they care, but are they that invested in it? And then you see almost that bolt of electricity between from the first goal onwards. There was just this greater zip and intensity and this real belief and electricity that was coursing around the stadium. And you're right. Well, Pickford was the one that stood out. You know, Muller puts it wide. He's then charging out, bounding around the goal. Declan Rice is like G-ing up the fans. And on some levels, I'm thinking, God, can they all just calm down for 5 minutes and see it through? But on the other hand, it was an amazing encapsulation of actually just look how much these guys give a shit. Look how much they care. And actually, we are all just feeling exactly the same thing here. And I didn't think this set of players were like so affected, I suppose, by that sense of beating Germany. I thought that was like an older generation thing, but it was clearly huge to them.
Yeah, there was a nervous energy that I was feeling that you could see them. And that's obviously where the mistake came from, is I think Sterling was a bit like, oh my God, I've just scored what could be one of the most historic goals in the history of English football. And I was physically shaking at that moment. Like, I couldn't control my body. And I was working in Trafalgar Square in the fan zone, and it was just utterly unreal. And you could feel that, like Adam was saying, you could feel they were feeling the same as all the fans. And I think it was that moment where you were like, oh, they want it just as much as we want it. They're fans too. And I think for years, there's been this separation of the players and the fans across all of football. And it's, I think England have done really well from Southgate all the way up, you know, to the marketing and social media team to build that connection back. And I think that match was just, you know, a complete definition of that, really.
And I think that point about emotional energy is just completely inseparable from the fact that there was a proper crowd in. Like, it was only, I mean, it was only, what, 25,000 more than we got in the group stage games. And yet it felt like 10 times that. And it didn't feel at all like a half capacity crowd or a limited crowd. You know, you could barely see any empty seats, to be honest. And it didn't feel like we were short of noise or anything. And you could tell the players fed into that. And one thing that I actually really liked and admired about the England crowd on Tuesday is that there were moments in the group stage, particularly in games that were not very entertaining or the fans wanted to see more from England, where, you know, Stones would pass the ball to another England defender and the fans would start getting really antsy because they didn't like that and they wanted to get it up there. And I think the fans were a bit impatient in the group stage, and I think that conveyed a bit of anxiety through to the players. That didn't happen at all on Tuesday. I thought the fans were fully patient. And even if the fans would rather play with a more attacking system, I don't think they conveyed any sense of frustration with Southgate or even with the players themselves. And I think that was hugely helpful to how England did play.
Just on that, there's a great piece, a tactical piece on The Athletic at the moment, written by Tom Morville and Mark Carey. And they talked to the assistant manager at Borussia Dortmund, René Maric, about England. And he highlights Kane, Rice and Phillips as players that should get huge credit. I mean, Adam, I kind of think Phillips has got a fair amount of credit, particularly for his performance in the first game against Croatia. Kane and Rice have got less credit, but from someone within the game, he is highlighting those three tactically.
I defer to him on Kane because I don't agree. With Declan Rice, yeah, it was interesting. I think after the group stage, he was probably one of the players I was looking at thinking, I'm still not 100% sure what you're doing. I know you're doing good things because everyone in the game says you're doing good things. But as a fan watching on, I was like, well, do we really need two of them? Obviously, you do when you play a big nation like a Germany or France or whoever it is. I thought Phillips was outstanding again against Germany. Just the intensity and pace at which he does things, I think, makes such a difference to the way that England play. Everything he does is with zip, whether it's a tackle or whether it's, you know, the speed of his pass or the speed of pressing. I really like it. I don't think you see it from enough players, just do everything at speed. Rice, I think, is far more intelligent positionally. I think that's clearly, you know, what he is doing well. And it's hard as well, you know. I think where it's interesting with Rice is that he's probably one of the few players in that team who's played a five-man defence most of the season, because West Ham do that, you know, that 5-2-3 system. He'll have played, he'll have known that role inside out. And he also picked up a really early yellow card. You know, when you had him on a yellow card within 10 minutes, you know, you're thinking, surely he's not going to see this game out. And he did. But it's funny, you know, it's like what we're saying about Southgate being vindicated, a genius now. You remember Man United played PSG at Old Trafford back in November. Fred had a really early yellow card. Solskjaer left him on, then one sort of soft booking later, and everyone's killing the manager. And it could have very easily happened with Rice and Phillips both on a booking. So I don't know if I'm missing something. You know, clearly I am, if the Borussia Dortmund assistant manager is saying that Harry Kane is doing great things tactically. Are there things I'm not seeing that he was doing? Do we just think the goal is going to make him take off? Was there anything you saw, Jack, at the stadium which you thought, yeah, that's what Kane's good at? That's what he's offering to the team. That's bringing space for Sterling and Saka.
Well, it actually reminded me quite a lot of his performance against Scotland, in the sense that he didn't look physically sharp. He literally barely touched the ball in the first half until that chance, which he tried to take it past Neuer, took a heavy touch and got tackled by Hummels. But then in games like that, you know, we've seen this 29 Champions League final, happens actually quite a lot for Tottenham now, where Kane can't really get in the game as a number nine. He's losing physical challenges. He got flattened by Hummels early in the second half and nearly had to limp off. And then over time, he realises that, in fact, he has to come a little bit deeper to get involved in the game. And to be honest, I did think he, from after he came back on following that moment where he nearly got subbed off, he did get better and he did seem to grow in influence in a slightly deeper role. Maybe it's just that Germany were getting tired as well. Hummels couldn't stick quite as tight to him. There's a little bit more room for him to operate in. And then, of course, he was involved in the build-up for the Sterling goal and then scored a goal himself. Whether it will be a launch for him later in the tournament, I mean, let's wait and see. I mean, I'd love to say yes, and I'd love to say this, you know, he's got the belief and the confidence and the momentum and everything, but he still doesn't look right physically. You know, I thought he did look right in the Czech Republic game, funnily enough, but then seemed to take a step back in the other direction for the Germany game. So I wouldn't be too bullish about Saturday on that basis.
Yeah, I mean, I, a bit like how I feel about Southgate's starting 11, I'm kind of just willing to go with it, with Kane. I've been impressed with his defensive work, and I just feel like what happened on Tuesday will happen again. He'll be in the right place at the right time and come up with the good. So I haven't been that frustrated, but I can understand, when he's had such a good season and you've seen what he can do over the last few years, why it's disappointing to see the way he's playing now. But I'm not too stressed about it. I would still start him, and I feel like he'll be in the right place at the right time.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
This is The England Show from The Athletic. Keep up to date with all of our Euro 2020 podcasts and writing by following us at The Athletic UK.
I just want a couple on Southgate the man, and then we'll look ahead to the game in Rome on Saturday. What moved you so much about the post-match interview, Adam, that you've already mentioned?
I think it was the pause.
I was looking at the big screen and I saw Dave Seaman up there, and, you know, I can't, for the teammates that played with me, I can't change that, so that's always going to hurt. But what's lovely is that we've given people another day to remember, and now we've got to go and do it in Rome.
And I don't know what it is. Every time I watch it, I've watched it back about 15 times now, and each time my bottom lip just sort of wobbles a little bit. I found it incredibly emotional. And I think it was almost just like this admission of this residual guilt that he clearly, all this time on, still matters to him and still feels to him. And, it, you know, an amazing column this morning by Alan Shearer in The Athletic.
Let me read what Alan said. So Gareth Southgate post-match said, "For teammates that played with me, I can't change that. That's always going to hurt," when talking about his penalty miss in 96. To which Alan has written today, Gareth, I've never once looked at you and blamed you. I've never thought of you as the man who cost me or who cost our England team a trophy and a winner's medal at the European Championship 25 years ago. I've never considered you a failure for taking a penalty against Germany and missing. There is not a spark in my brain or an atom in my body that thinks in those terms. I could have delivered that in a different way for comic effect, but I won't. And I hate that you might suspect otherwise.
I can feel my eyes sort of watering a bit as you read that, because it's such a national moment, and for him to, you know, to basically, I just felt like he bared a little bit of his soul to, what was it, probably more than 50 million people watching on the BBC at that time. I thought it was a really brave thing to do. The reaction to it as well from Shearer is fantastic. It made me feel so bad for doubting him. Like the text messages I was sending 25 minutes before that interview about Gareth Southgate, you know, I felt so bad.
I've got them.
Jack's got them. half my contact book have got them. And half the country was sending them. The whole country is going to be pretending forevermore that they never once doubted Gareth Southgate, when after 70 minutes, I would say that three quarters of the people watching probably were. But that's okay. That's the point of football. We're meant to be irrational watching football and hope that the guy who makes the decision is the smartest guy in the room, and he's proven to be so.
Yeah, it hurts because, in retrospect, for Adam, I'm guessing, Flo, it hurts because Southgate has always been a decent man. There you go. He's a decent man. And I mean that in the most complimentary of terms.
Yeah, and I think what's really sad about Southgate is he is kind of the walking embodiment of nice guys don't always win. And I think what would be so great about England's potential success is that it changes that narrative, because he has spent a lot of his career being a loser. And I think it would be great for him to be able to change that. And I think some people don't like Southgate because they think he's too plain and he's too risk averse. But I think he's, by showing more emotion, by showing more of his personality, he's opening up that side of things. And you think, well, no wonder he doesn't want to take any risks, because he's seen some shit. Like, he's been there and he didn't have a good time. So he's trying to, you know, he's trying to manage that with this incredible job that he's trying to do.
I think for a lot of people before Tuesday, the take on Southgate would have been something along the lines of, great bloke, so much admiration for him. I love the way that he talks. I love the way that he represents our national team and is and speaks for English football in a way that nobody else really has the moral authority to do. And I love his commitment to diversity and inclusion and giving agency back to the young players, and helping a new generation of England fans believe in the England team again, and all this stuff. But I've got my doubts about him as a coach. I think there was a lot of that. And now, for the first time, really, people can say, well, you know, as well as all that great stuff about him as a person, he's actually quite good at the managing stuff as well. You know, this yesterday, or not yesterday, Tuesday, whenever it was the first time, really, that he's done anything like this, like tactically masterminded a win against a really good team in a really important game. It's never happened before. You know, we didn't beat anyone good in 2018, but now we have. And I just think that is, for the first time, really, that I think the national sense of Southgate, the coach, is not quite at the level as the national sense of Southgate, the man, but it's getting closer. And that's not something that people were necessarily expecting to happen this summer.
My sense before the game is that I'm so happy this man is leading this group, but I'm not sure I want him coaching this group. I think that was where I was at with Southgate. And I was like, you know, we're getting a lot of the compromise without any of the payoff. Is it all worth it, sort of thing? And, you know, he's proven us wrong. I still think they could have won by playing more aggressively and expansively. You know, just because they've won this way doesn't necessarily mean they wouldn't have won with a few more creative players on the pitch. I am standing by that text message. Germany weren't very good.
There's a great look on Jack's face that he realises he has all the power in this pod and presumably future pods to be able to just drop some of those messages in whenever he so chooses.
Well, it wasn't just Adam. I mean, Adam's right. But Adam, if you can speak for this huge swathe of the English football public who were initially Southgate critical, Southgate sceptical, however we want to phrase this, Do you accept on behalf of all those people that the 3-4-3 was correct and that he can't just play all my favourite players at the same time because it'd be more fun that way?
You know, I'm going to admit, when it went to 1-0, and I was really quite resentful about 3 minutes before 1-0 because I was just, my feeling was just, we've got all these creative players on the bench and what if this occasion just passes us by and Germany get this late goal? You know, I don't think that's an unreasonable position. And Southgate said afterwards, you know, he'd have been dead and he's right. Then when we scored, part of me was, how much do I want to be right here? Yeah, look, I mean, he got the result, so therefore he's right. England are in the quarterfinals of the Euros and have a fantastic chance to win it. You know, it'd be ridiculous to say he got it wrong. All I'm saying is I think he might have got it right by also starting Phil Foden or Jack Grealish, which we'll never know. Purely because I felt, even in the first half, whenever England pressed or really got after Germany, they looked really vulnerable. I didn't think it was a good German side. And, you know, in that last 15 minutes was probably actually the most aggressive that England played. So really, if we'd have played like that throughout the game, we could have won 5-1.
Well, I sort of half agree with you in the sense that I think that the 3-4-3 was definitely integral to how England won the game, in the sense that it allowed them to exert kind of 1v1 pressure on Germany, pin back the German wing-backs, which was really the crucial thing, and stop Germany from doing to England what Germany had done to Portugal beforehand. So I think the 3-4-3 was integral in kind of pinning back, wearing down Germany and eventually picking them off. That said, I do think you're probably right that England could have played, say, Foden instead of Saka and got more or less a similar result. I don't think Saka was quite as influential as he was in the Czech Republic game. So theoretically, he could have played Foden instead of Saka. That said, I don't think he could have played Grealish instead of Saka because it was the introduction of a fully fresh Grealish on 65 minutes against tiring German defenders that was so important. And really, I think, another decision that paid off.
With Saka, as England were really nervous early on, particularly first 10, 15 minutes, I thought he was the one that just had that little bit less fear, that little bit of innocence. You know, he took a couple of players on, he had a bit of a dribble. I think he actually, by being a little bit inventive and brave, sort of helped calm the situation down. I'm sure there's something smart that the data guys can come up with about how all his running tired out Germany and then Grealish could come on and make the most of it.
This may bring the mood down a little bit. I don't know. But we talked right at the start about needing luck in all of this flow. And England have been very lucky the way this tournament has been structured because they've had every game at Wembley so far. And it's hard not to disagree with Chris Gunter's comment about this tournament being shambolic when it comes to, you know, where teams are playing and travelling and so on and so forth. How much does it change for England, in your opinion, that they're not at Wembley for this quarterfinal?
I think it would have been a game changer, and obviously no disrespect to Ukraine, but this is the reality of things, if it would have been England-Germany in Rome. I mean, we talked about the impact the fans had on Tuesday, and they're not going to be able to recreate that. Like, you know, whoever gets to go, whoever's going to take the risk or can afford it or whatever. Like, I've seen a couple of people on Instagram with tickets offering to sell them affordable, 80 quid, you know, for a Euros quarterfinal to see England. But it's just impossible to travel at the moment, especially if you're a fan and you can't get any sort of exemption or anything. So I think it's going to be really, really difficult atmosphere-wise to get that same emotion, to get that same energy. And it'll be interesting to see how that impacts England. But I think the way the draws worked out, I think, you know, luck will still be on the side in the sense that they are on the quote-unquote easy side of the draw. I think the worry for me is not Ukraine, it's Denmark. The possibility of Denmark, I think, in the semi-final is more worrying about it. But that will be back at Wembley. So I think travelling, I think, I can't remember who mentioned it in their piece about the superstitious nature of players and now travelling to Rome kind of upsets the balance. I can't remember who was talking about that in their Athletic piece, but I think that's a big factor, less the atmosphere and the fans, but disrupting the vibes and the St. George's
routine.
Yeah, the routine, the St. George's Park little Big Brother comfort house that they have, disrupting that I think is a big one.
I think they kind of need to get over it though, don't they? I mean, you know, when you look at England's route in this tournament compared to, you know, I've been covering Belgium quite closely. Belgium's group stage, they had an away game in Russia, an away game in Denmark, then played in Copenhagen again against Finland. Then they went to the the desert to play in Seville against Portugal, losing a number of players across the process. Then they go to Munich. I mean, they've basically had like a Champions League style tournament while England have been at home the whole time. So I think England have had it as good as you could possibly want it. And the one time they're having to travel is probably as kind of fixture as they could have hoped for in the quarterfinal stage of a competition. I think that, you know, I don't think it's that bad as well either for them to just get out of England for a few days. A lot of hype going on, get them in their cocoon. And also, you know, players do enjoy, I think, as well, you know, that bonding that you get from a trip and that idea of a bit of an expedition as well. So I think it's quite good for them. And then you come back to Wembley for the semi-final and maybe the final.
Yeah, there is part of me that wishes that England were... This game should really have been against Spain if things had gone normally. Like, Spain would have won that group instead of Sweden. And then, you know, if Spain had beaten Ukraine in the last 16 game late on Tuesday night, then it would have been England-Spain. Although we've got, you know, Alvaro Morata's finishing in those first two games to thank for England having a slightly... Well, in theory, should be a slightly easier game. In terms of how it goes... That does remind me a little bit of in 2018 when England had this emotionally exhausting last 16 win against Colombia in Moscow, which in the end was a hugely transformative moment for the Southgate tenure and also, I think, for the national mood. And then the quarterfinal against Sweden was actually a much more quiet, calm event against, to be honest, not as good a team as Colombia. And the dynamic does remind me a bit of that. Like, will England be able to... Because in 2018, I thought England managed, you know, coming down from the emotional high of Croatia into playing quite an effective and efficient game against Sweden really well. And that's what they have to do this time. Because if they get too confident and emotional and wrapped up in, oh, didn't we beat Germany? It was fantastic. They can definitely lose to Ukraine. Like, Ukraine have got more than enough good players. I don't think the crowd will be on England's side at all. And it wouldn't take too much of a slip up for England to get beaten. So it's managing that emotional transfer will be interesting.
Are you basing the crowd not being on England's side on the fact that there'll be more Ukraine there, or are you basing it on how Eurovision goes every year and basically
everyone
hates us?
Yeah, both. A bit of all three, and also people like an underdog. You know,
I think you're right, Jack, though, about how they deal with the emotional high. You know, we've spoken so much about how England come back from lows over the years. But, you know, one of the hardest things people say in sport, because I have not had an emotional high in sport as a participant, is, you know, how do you deal with a huge win that you've not really had that experience of before? And when I interviewed Roberto Martinez before this tournament started, he was talking about when Belgium beat Brazil at the World Cup in 2018 in the quarterfinal. They then only had a few days before they then played France in the semi-final. And he said, you know, one of the things he looked back on, apart from the, you know, the physical drain, was that he just felt his players just stayed too high after that. And like, you don't want to knock their confidence down, because you want your players to be confident. And it's very, very difficult. It's not something that sports scientists can measure. It's not something that the metrics have the answer to. It's all about sportsmen being consistent, performing at a high level of consistency while dealing with all this noise around them. And that was why I thought it was really interesting what we were talking about before, that last 10 minutes where, you know, you saw that reaction from Sterling and Trippier and Rice getting the fans up and Pickford. That was, are they dealing with this in the way that you want elite sportsmen to deal with it? And yeah, it worked against Germany, but I do think that's one of the things Southgate will have been really working on the last couple of days. Less probably about tactics now and more, you know, if your heads are right playing Ukraine, you win that game.
I think he did say as well, when he came out to his post-match, he did say that in the changing room, they were all going for it, blasting music, and he had to go and say, like, everyone needs to chill out. And I think he's already showing those signs. But, I mean, our heads were gone as fans after that game, so I don't know what they must have felt. And we'll never know if volleyball in the swimming pool at St. George's Park yesterday was a good idea or a bad idea. We'll never know.
I was speaking to someone close to Jordan Pickford yesterday, and they were saying how, you know, Pickford has spoken openly about hiring a sports psychologist over the past 18 months or so, and the impact that that's had on his game. And, you know, on one level, it was about calming him down, you know, from some of the mistakes he's made and some of the negative experiences. But one of the things that he's also been working on is how do you deal with those moments after you've made a great save or that big chance goes wide and things like that? Because, you know, as I said before, dealing with success is in sport is actually almost as important with dealing with failure, because you've got to go and do it again.
And this is why I wonder whether he might bring in some different players, maybe some cooler heads for the Ukraine game, just players who are maybe less kind of running off the buzz of that first game. I think Henderson is a really obvious selection for this game, not just because Rice and Phillips are on yellows, but obviously Henderson, you know, he's won the Premier League, won a Champions League, he's done everything in the game. And he's just a very experienced, cool head. Maybe Mason Mount as well. He's a big game player. Maybe Phil Foden. Just so that England have got a little bit of fresh, clear thinking on the pitch on Saturday.
Well, we'll come on to your starting 11s for the game in just a moment. But let's talk Ukraine. They knocked Sweden out in the last 16. That was a game that took place at Hampden Park, and it was watched by The Athletic Scottish writer Jordan Campbell, and I spoke to him earlier.
Again, space for Zinchenko. It's a good ball in, and there it is! Artem Dovbyk with his fierce international goal, and surely a historic victory for the Ukraine.
So Jordan, you were in Hampden watching this game. What did you make of Ukraine?
I thought we were pretty one-paced, to be honest. Like, I know Shevchenko moved to a back three, so maybe that had more to do with it, because when you watched them in the group stage, their games were pretty exciting. I don't think they looked great, but they were always exciting games. But then I think what you've seen against Austria, where they sort of struggled to really create much, was against Sweden, like a pretty flat 4-4-2, just set up to soak up the pressure. And Ukraine, you know, most of the possession was pretty limited to playing it across the back three, trying to get it to Zinchenko down the left. But for a lot of the time, they couldn't really get it to him. But obviously, the two times they did, they get a goal, two goals from it. So it'll be interesting to know whether Shevchenko sticks with that against England, and then obviously whether England then match up against it. But, you know, they've got players that can hurt teams, clearly. Like, you know, Yarmolenko, even Chaparenko as well, the number 10 that played. You know, they were the two sort of main threats. They like to try and switch the ball quite quickly. Yarmolenko sort of given a bit of freedom to really, you know, drift out to the right and then cut inside, and that's when he obviously looks at his best. So, aye, no, they've definitely got threats, but I wasn't overly impressed by them on the ball.
One of the difficulties of doing this tournament is that, for the most part, we are remote, and therefore you can't really get that feeling of talking to, just bumping into some fans, journalists from all the different countries that you go and witness when you're at these tournaments, when you're all in one place. You, by being at Hampden, might have had a chance to talk to Ukrainian journalists or Ukrainian fans. I have no idea whether you did.
There was a few Ukrainians actually who in the media who travelled behind me. They were sitting in the row behind me, actually, so it was safe to say they lost their inhibitions when that goal went in towards the end, but that was brilliant. I mean, I was surprised, actually, even just walking to Hampden, you could see, I've seen a few, there's a fairly good size of Swedish population in Glasgow. There's a few guys in Swedish kilts, and there's like a few Ukrainians who had clearly got the memo as well, but there was actually quite a decent travelling support. And over in that far corner, you know, they ended up all sort of congregating. I mean, I think they were technically supposed to, but you know, it was great to see that. It was great to see that at the end, because, as you say, like, you're sort of detached from it a bit, apart from when it is at Wembley or when it's been at Hampden, sadly no longer. But you know, Ukraine were they're great travelling support, and to see that sort of outburst of emotion at the end was brilliant.
So did they, after the game, give you any indication of what they're expecting against England?
Well, I mean, Shevchenko obviously spoke about the fact that England have so much strength and depth, and that, you know, there's probably a variety of ways that they could set up against England. So, you know, I think the interesting thing for England looking at Ukraine is that, you know, they're starting 11 against Sweden. You've got, I think, 8 of the players all playing Ukraine still. So, to a large extent, they will be an unknown quantity to a lot of fans. But in terms of England, I think, you know, the players will be well known to them and Shevchenko, but I would imagine they're going to stick with that system that they used against Sweden. That would seem the most likely thing to me.
I'm guessing as well that now there'll be, do Ukraine become the Scottish people's side? because they played at Hampden, presumably. I mean, that's.
Oh yeah, that's it. We really look after those who have visited the National Stadium fondly. I think there's how do I put this diplomatically? Without saying anybody but England, I think there is a groundswell of support for Ukraine after the victory. But you know, I think, to be honest, I said this last time, was I don't think there's a big thing against the players or Southgate, like for Scotland. Most Scotland, it's not really the team, it's more like just the circus that goes around it. Like you know, I think a lot of the things is like the half time having to listen to like England interviews every time you try to watch like another game. I think that's the thing that really bugs people. Not me, clearly, as you can tell, but you know, I'll be honest, I don't think Ukraine are going to upset England, but I don't think it'll be a walk in the park either, because they're quite a competitive team. So and obviously in the quarterfinals.
Just one final thing on Zinchenko, because it's kind of easy of the British media to focus, English media if you want, to focus on Zinchenko just because he's a Manchester City, in the same way you kind of focus on Yarmolenko a little bit. But I think in your article, did you describe him as the son of Ukraine? Is that how they view him?
Well, I think so, because I mean, like, the reason they play him, usually play a sort of 4-3-3 and put him in the middle, is obviously because he is probably the best player. So they obviously try to maximise that. But you know, being shunted at left wing back is probably nowhere you would want your main playmaker. But they managed to make it work because, as I say, they tried to get it to him as often as possible. You could see that when they did the thunderclap at the end. Actually brought back memories of Iceland, so we might be seeing that again on Friday. But there was him, obviously, Shevchenko, who I imagine is a god over there. And then obviously you had Dovbyk as well, who got the winner at the end. So you know, it did lack a wee bit up front. So it'll be interesting to know whether he starts, actually, because you know, it was a Ukrainian podcast based in London, I think, and they've been banging on about him for a couple of weeks now. So it'll be interesting to see whether that goal gets him in. But nah, Zinchenko is clearly the poster boy, I think. You could see how much it means to him. Like you see that Man City, just how you know, passionate and aggressive he is for being quite a compact player. But no, he's he was really impressive again.
This episode is supported by FX's Welcome to Wrexham. Celebrity owners Rob McElhenney and Ryan Reynolds' small-town Welsh football club has finally been promoted into League 2 after 15 seasons in the National League. Dedicated staff and supporters celebrate the city's return to glory while bracing for the newfound challenges that come with being in a higher league. Will Wrexham AFC stand up to the challenge and rise again into League 1? FX's Welcome to Wrexham premieres May 2nd on FX. Stream on Hulu.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
So before we get on to the teams that you three are going to select, let's just look at some of the great articles that are on The Athletic. I'd like to point people towards James Horncastle's article on the relationship between Mancini and Vialli, which is just a beautiful, beautiful article that made me well up, actually, as I was reading it. So I heartily suggest that you go and read that at some point. And remember, you can subscribe for just £1 a month at the moment by heading to theathletic.com/EnglandPod, theathletic.com/EnglandPod, and you get all the articles for £1 a month. What's caught your eye, Flo?
I really liked Jordan's piece from that Ukraine game. I thought there was some really nice insight, because He reflects on the fact that Ukraine have been kind of inconsistent with the way they performed and the way that Shevchenko set them up. So that's going to be really hard for Southgate to prepare the team for, because you kind of don't know which Ukraine is going to turn up.
With your United head on, Adam, are you going for Laurie's piece on where Manchester United will play Jadon Sancho?
Yes, because you're not going to find out with England at this rate.
I have to say, it feels very... Look, I know they've been after Sancho for ages, and I'm doing this tongue-in-cheek, but it does feel very United that their transfer policy is so far involved buying someone from England who hasn't even played, and looking at a French centre-half who had an absolute... who looked every inch a typical United centre-half when he played for France against Switzerland the other night.
Talking to someone near Real Madrid last week, and they were saying that Real Madrid were hoping Varane had a fantastic tournament so it would create an auction for him. And now you're actually struggling to convince teams to meet anywhere near the asking price that Madrid have set out. That was an interesting piece by Laurie on Sancho, who I agree, tongue in cheek, but I think it is a fantastic, exciting signing for United to have Greenwood, Rashford, Sancho. This isn't a Manchester United podcast. I need to stop talking about United. But also, we've also got a piece about what went on with the French team over the past...
And the mums,
which is amazingly entertaining. But there's also some really interesting context to it that you wouldn't expect, particularly in regards to Rabiot's mum, stuff that you wouldn't necessarily... when you first see that story, you think, oh, my God, it's just a story about a really involved, crazy mum. And then the background is... her husband had locked-in syndrome. She was single-handedly bringing up the kids by herself. She personally negotiated Rabiot's, first few contracts as a professional player. And you just realise that there's always context and background, however chaotic it may seem. But a lot of info there also about Pogba's role, about Deschamps' future, and also the impact that bringing Benzema had on the sort of general harmony of the squad as well.
Jack?
Yeah, that's a great piece, that France piece. If I was going to recommend something, I've just been really enjoying Michael Cox's England analysis all the way through. Like every single England game, he brings quite a unique eye to it, which I don't really think there's anything quite like that out there elsewhere. And every game he'll he'll pick something out which you wouldn't have necessarily noticed, whether in this case it was, England's, the way that Shaw and Trippier helped to pin back the German wing-backs, which is obviously integral to how England played, and the very kind of aggressive defence that England had against Germany. So I really, every time I read Coxie, I learn something. So, we'd definitely recommend them.
Well, let's start with you then, Jack, for the starting 11, bearing in mind, so you've read all of Michael Cox's stuff. Jordan highlighted there that Ukraine have played three at the back. So do you match Ukraine up? What are you doing?
No, so I'm going back to the 4-2-3-1, which I think is the best way for England to create chances against more defensive opposition. I think the defence is easy. I've got Pickford, Walker, Stones, Maguire, Shaw. Then I've got Henderson and Rice sitting, so I'm resting Calvin Phillips. The next three is interesting. I've definitely got Sterling, I've definitely got Mount back in, and then one extra spot, a few different candidates, but I'm going to go for Grealish over Foden and Saka, just to reward Grealish for his sub-appearance the other day. And then obviously Harry Kane up front.
Okay. By leaving Foden and Phillips out, is that partly because of their yellow cards?
In part, yeah. I love Foden. I've not been massively convinced with him so far in this tournament, his first two games. I think he's a brilliant individual player, but I don't think he quite clicks into this England system yet.
Okay. Flo?
So I'm going to stick with the 3-4-3, but it's going to be more of a 3 than the sort of 5 that we saw a lot against Germany out of possession. So hopefully it won't be too defensive. Sticking with the sort of 3/5 that played the other day, so Pickford, Walker, Stones, Maguire, then Trippier, Mount, Rice, Shaw. I'm going to keep Rice in despite the yellow card, but I do agree with Jack that I imagine Henderson might come in. We haven't really seen much of him yet, and this is kind of the perfect game for him to be that kind of centre linchpin in midfield and keep people's heads, basically. And then, like Jack, I'm going to bring Grealish in. I love him as this impact sub, and I am a little bit, not worried, but I do think actually it's just that, is that the best way to use him? Is to get everyone chanting his name, him to know that, he's got to come on and change the game, and then just kind of drop him in. And actually, it'll be quite interesting to see what would happen if he did start. So the front three is going to be Sterling, Kane and Grealish.
And Adam, now remember Jordan off air, before I spoke, said that you were talking about rotating players, already getting ahead of yourself. So what have you done with your starting 11?
I think it's quite logical. If you take the view that England are on paper, significantly better than Ukraine, and that England, in the best case scenario, could have three incredibly emotional football matches over the course of a week with the possibilities of extra time in at least one of those. You know, I don't think you can just go through that thinking we're going to use 14 players because Southgate's never going to make five subs. I'll go Pickford in goal. Then I would go Walker, Stones.
Tyrone Mings could be coming back here.
Well, I just wonder, you know, Maguire, you know, having just come back from an injury to play possibly five games in the space of two and a bit weeks, it's a lot.
And he's on a yellow.
I can't drop Harry Maguire, but I do think that's a legitimate conversation that they will be having internally around, you know, what his fitness is like. Luke Shaw, I always think he's best playing as much as possible, plays his best football when he plays back to back. I would also go Henderson and Rice. Because I think Henderson and Phillips are a bit similar in that they both like to, you know, to roam a little bit from that position. Rice, you need that stability. I'm then going Foden, Foden, Grealish, and Sterling, and Kane up front. I just think, you know, Mount's obviously been away from the group for 8 days or so. It's not his fault, but I didn't think he was. Contrary to what a lot of other people seem to think, I thought Foden was better than Mount in the game against Scotland. I thought he looked more likely to really do something. And we've got to get Grealish. There's so much hype around him. He's got to start at some point, doesn't he? Otherwise, there'll be no one left on Twitter to send Jack abuse for not trusting him enough.
Right, we got that. That was nearly Garrido-esque in the length of time it took you to explain your starting 11. Flo, Adam, Jack, thank you. That's it for now. Dan back on Sunday with all the reaction from the Ukraine game. It's still as positive as ever, Flo?
Yeah, definitely.
Leave it there. Bye.
We've been so positive. We can't lose now, can we, surely?
The Athletic.